Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, a radio show about the Constitution, brought to you in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS HD1 and WETS FM 89.5 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Well, we have a first for you today. We've had several firsts recently. It wasn't long ago we had our first NFL player, Chris Cluey, talked to us all about gay rights and the First Amendment and things of that sort. We had our first interview with a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist just recently when we spoke to Linda Greenhouse. But today, we have our first interview with an actor. Yes, an actor. His name is Fred Moorsell, and Fred Moorsell has spent the last, well, roughly 30 years portraying primarily one person. And that person is someone you've probably heard of, but perhaps don't know a great deal about. And that person is Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, one of the most important figures in the abolitionist movement of the middle 19th century, a man who was born into slavery, who escaped slavery, and who began arguing against slavery pretty much from the moment he escaped it. It's a fascinating tale, and it begins with another fascinating tale, the fascinating tale of how Fred Moorsell himself started portraying Frederick Douglass.
I've been working professionally as an actor since 1968, when I began working at the Actors Theater of Louisville in Louisville, Kentucky. And sometime in 1984, I'm originally from New York City, and sometime in 1984, things in the economy. I'm a black actor, and in the mid '70s, as you may recall, and your listeners may recall, there was a burgeoning of opportunity for black actors with programs like All in the Family, The Jeffersons, mm-hmm. Good Times, and a variety of other opportunities. And people who are now, you know, household names, but people have been hearing about for the last 20 years, we were all fairly much in our 20s and 30s at the time. And in any case, by the time we got to the end of the 70s, and not so much necessarily related to the election of Reagan, but bottom line is the economy really took a nosedive toward the end of the 70s. And what normally happens in the theater, at least, is that when the economy is not doing particularly well, people want to go to be entertained and movies and plays and things like that, just their minds off the difficulties they're going through. It didn't really happen quite following that pattern at that period of time. And so as a result, there was a real tightening of the amount of opportunity that was. To make a long story short, in the early 80s, my manager and I in New York City decided that I should consider going to Los Angeles and trying to see if I could get some work there. And fortunately, I got a job with Sports Illustrated magazine doing what they called industrials, which are shows that where actors are hired to do programs for advertisers, okay?
Uh-huh.
And so I found myself in L.A. and I decided to stay out there to try to see if I could make things a little bit better for myself economically. And one thing led to another, and I met in the late spring of 84 a black minister. And he was telling me about conditions going on in South Central L.A. Among young black kids who were being used as drug runners. This is basically South Central L.A.
Right.
And what was happening is a number of them were ODing on crack cocaine because they were being given, I don't mean to be too graphic here.
That's all right.
They were being given balloons filled with crack cocaine, and they'd be coated with Coca-Cola syrup or some other kind of very sweet kind of liquid, and they would swallow these balloons, and then they'd go and make the run. And when they got to where they had to deliver the crack to the dealer, they would basically stick their fingers down their throat and try to regurgitate this thing up.
Oh, boy.
In a few cases, they were not able to do so. And so the thing, the balloon, would either blow up in their belly, or if they could get it partly out, it would suffocate them. That's because they couldn't get out of their throat. And people were really, really frightened by what had happened. Now, this is 1984, so this is basically 30 years ago. And the drug culture was becoming really horrendous at that time. Today, it is 50 times worse than then. And the bottom line is that this black minister wanted to form a little organization and try to help young black kids in that area understand that doing drugs is not the way to find success in life. And he wanted to call it the Frederick Douglass Foundation. And fortunately or unfortunately, as I look at it now, it was probably very fortunate. I was not having a great deal of success in getting work, and so I had a fair amount of time. But I realized that if I was going to work with him in some capacity, I didn't quite know how, I needed to learn something about Frederick Douglass. And the truth is that even though I graduated from Frederick Douglass Elementary School, that's what it was called, in Harlem in 1952, I did not know anything about him, despite the fact that I had grown up in the civil rights movement, because my father, Dr. John Albert Morcel, was the associate executive director of the NAACP for 19 years, from 1956 to 1974 when he died. And so people like Roy Wilkins, Thurgood Marshall, Whitney Young, Gloucester Current, of course Martin Luther King, and a variety of other people were household names, and my dad knew all of these folks. I did not know all of them, but I did know Roy, because our families were very close. The important thing is that despite having grown up in the civil rights struggle, having graduated from a very good high school in 1958, having graduated from a good college in 62, I knew nothing about, really about black history. And I couldn't even be sure that Frederick Douglass had either been a slave. I thought he'd been associated with a group of people called the abolitionists, but I wasn't certain who they were. And so I needed to learn something about it.
Well, you know, Fred, I'm so glad that you begin with that, because I'm just going to take a wild guess that many people listening to this sort of shamefacedly admit the same thing, you know, to themselves at least. They've heard the name, but they really don't know much more about him. And I think that's why we're here today, isn't it, to rectify that.
Well, here's the thing. It was an interesting thing. When I did the Bill Moyers Journal on PBS back in 1994 during Black History Month in February. And at one point he said to me, he asked me, he said, "You've been doing Douglass now for a number of years," at that point about 10 years. And he said, "I wonder how many kids know who he was. I would assume that most people, when they hear the name Frederick Douglass, they would think he's a linebacker for the Redskins." I said, yeah, to a great extent, there is that reality. But by the time we'd gotten to the early 90s and even later, his name is much more well-known. But people may not know very much about his life. They just know he's a very famous person from the 19th century. The fact is, however, I needed to learn something about his life as quickly as I could. And I got a hold of his first autobiography. He published three of them. The first was called The Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave, written by himself. And by the time I started reading that book, when I first started reading it, I was kind of embarrassed, because within the first dozen pages or so, he was using words that I was not familiar with. And that kind of embarrassed and irritated me, because, you know, I have a master's degree in theater arts and all that kind of thing, so I thought I was a pretty intelligent, pretty educated man. But by the time I finished reading that book, I realized that there were three things that this young man had realized. Number one, his reality, his inner strength, who he really was, had nothing to do with the external characteristics of his skin color. That all came from within himself, which basically we all look at and consider the strength, our real strength comes from the heart. Secondly, he discovered that if you want anything in life, you must be willing to take advantage of every opportunity that you're presented, because among other things, you never know if that's going to be the last one you get. And thirdly, he discovered the power of the spoken word and the power of the written word as the most effective means by which you can bring about permanent positive changes, not only in your own life, but in the lives of those with whom you live in the society. And so those three things struck me as being very, very important aspects of his legacy. I thought to myself, wouldn't it be a wonderful thing to tell his story to a group of say, black kids? Then I thought to myself, what age would be the right age? And what popped into my head suddenly was the age of 9. But I thought to myself, no, that doesn't make sense, because his writing, his syntax, his linguistic skills are way beyond anything that a 9-year-old would be able to understand. Until about maybe 4 years later, in 1988, I found myself at the University of Colorado doing a presentation for their theater department. And when the performance was over, I was talking to some friends backstage, and I was introduced to a little young black girl whose mother had brought her to the performance. And I asked her some questions, and she was very excited about having heard about Frederick Douglass and all that, and she said, "I know a lot about him." And when I asked her some questions, she answered them all correctly, and then I asked her, "Well, how old are you?" She said, 9. So then I realized that Douglass's message is something that can be received by almost anyone of any age, primarily because it's not words that people are relating to. They are relating to the passion, to the fire, to the images that he paints, because he's one of those rare writers who's able to write with pictures. And when you read the narrative, particularly the narrative is perhaps the most evocative in terms of imagery than of the other two, but you read and you can literally see what he's describing. And it's a wonderful way to get into a period of time that most of us know very little about. And he's able to paint pictures that in some cases really dramatize the horrors in a way that you would not understand it if you just heard about it from someone else. And at the same time gives you an insight as to how things can really be better and how we can move forward out of these kinds of horrible circumstances and find a way for creating a niche for ourselves of success. And that's what Douglas did. And so I was.
What's the title of his autobiography again, Jeff? I'm sure.
The first one is entitled Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass.
Okay.
And it's spelled with two S's, D-O-U-G-L-A-S-S. First name is F-R-E-D-E-R-I-C-K. An American Slave, written by himself.
All right, and I'm sure people can get that.
In 1845.
Right. I'm sure there may be a number of people are going to want to get that now and read that story. Okay.
It's a magnificent story, yes. And then the next two, My Bondage and My Freedom, and published in 1855, and then in 1881, and he revised it for the next 10 or 11 years, in 1892, The Life and Times of Frederick Douglass. Each one builds upon the previous one, but the narrative, the first one, is the most immediate. And the reason for that is because when he wrote the narrative, he was writing it in the midst of giving speeches telling his life with the abolitionists in Massachusetts. And this is from 1841 to 1845. And the reason he wrote the narrative was in large part to prove to people that, in fact, he had been a slave, because they didn't believe that he was. He sounded too educated. He didn't talk enough about his background in terms of the names of his master, where he lived, and so on and so forth. And he did not do that because he was still a fugitive in 1845.
Well, we're getting ahead of ourselves, Fred. Now, this is a great introduction, but I really want to go back. Let's go back to when he was born, and let's do it chronologically. Tell me the story of Frederick Douglass.
Okay, he was born probably on Valentine's Day in 1818 on Maryland's eastern shore, near the county of Talbot, T-A-L-B-O-T. And the seat of the county is Easton, Maryland, E-A-S-T-O-N.
Mm-hmm.
His mother was a slave. Her name was Harriet Bailey. He had three siblings born before he was born, a brother, Perry, a sister, Sarah, and a sister, Eliza. They were all older than he was. Subsequent to his birth, his mother had two other children, Kitty and Ariana, and I don't believe that Douglas ever saw them or met them. He did meet his other siblings, particularly Eliza and Perry. His master was a man by the name of Aaron Anthony. And Aaron Anthony was a slaveholder himself. He owned about 14 slaves and two or three relatively moderate-sized farms. But Aaron Anthony was the chief overseer of all the plantations and property owned by Colonel Edward Lloyd. And Edward Lloyd was one of the wealthiest slave owners, not only in Maryland, but in the United States. On two separate occasions, he was elected the governor of the state. I believe once he was also the senator from the state of Maryland. And the plantation that he owned was located on a river called the Wye River, W-Y-E, that flows into the Chesapeake Bay. So it's on Maryland's eastern shore. It was about a 14 or 15,000 acre piece of property. Hundreds of slaves were there. Douglas was born in a small cabin where his grandmother, Betsy Bailey, and his grandfather, Isaac Bailey, were able to live. Within a few days or possibly a week or so after his birth, his mother was sent to work on a farm nearby. Because that was the process. You were born, after you were weaned from your mother, then you were basically sent, then the mothers and the families were separated. And he only saw his mother maybe a total of five or six times in his entire life. And she died when he was about 7 years of age. So he was raised by his grandmother and his grandfather. One interesting thing about his grandfather, Isaac Bailey, is that he was a free man.
That is interesting.
Sometimes students ask me, well, why, if he was a free man, would he stay with his slave wife and his family in basically in slavery? And I think it informs a great deal about some of the complications that are not necessarily treated when history of slavery is discussed or taught in this country. there was a tremendous sense of loyalty that the slave family felt within itself. And that's one of the things that was so important in terms of the success of slavery, to destroy that, so that the only thing that the slave would feel any sense of loyalty toward would be the slave master, not to the family. Because when you can destroy a sense of identity with your family, you're very far along the road toward destroying any sense of identity at all. And if the only possibility that you can, of something you can identify with, happens to be something that is, let's say, deleterious to you in the form of a whip or shooting or fear or anything like that, that is what you gravitate to, because that's the natural instinct of human nature, to gravitate toward something toward which you can identify, even if what it's identifying with is negative or destructive. You follow what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. In fact, this is chillingly reminiscent of George Orwell's book, 1984, where they tried to destroy any family relationship and only love the state. And wow.
That is correct. And that's one of the great keys to the success of slavery for almost 300 years in this country. And one of the things I say to students, and I just came back from a two-week trip on the East Coast, one of the things I say to students, particularly high school students who are much more savvy with what's going on in the world, is that you need to understand that if you want to destroy a culture or a society, you destroy all sense of family. And of course, we live in a society today in which broken families are almost the norm.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very, very clear thing, because if you want slavery to succeed, you start by destroying any sense of identity with your family. So in any case, the bottom line is that he lived with his grandfather chose to stay with his wife and family because of that sense of loyalty and love for the family. And that's something that's frequently not covered or made important enough in understanding the black culture and the black society in this country. That's part of our tradition. Blacks are not naturally, they used to be saying, one of the things they used to say in slavery is that blacks don't know how to love. They don't know how to have families. Well, in point of fact, Douglass's experience, or Frederick Bailey's experience with his grandfather and his grandmother, belied that.
Yeah, in fact, the fact that his grandfather stuck around as a free man could be seen as an act of resistance.
He could very well be. So in any case, he was with his grandparents for about 6 years, and one night, or one day rather, his grandmother took him on what he thought was going to be a nice long walk. And what happened was she had been ordered to take him to the plantation to become a slave for Captain Anthony, who was their master. And she left him there and never told him that that's what she was going to do. And that bitterness and that disappointment and that sense of resentment of having been betrayed by the one person in the world whom he really loved more than anyone else, because he knew his grandmother better than he knew anyone else, better than he knew his mother, because he only saw his mother maybe four or five times. So that is something that fed his anti-slavery urge and resistance for his entire life. And he was at the plantation. He lived there for a couple of years. And when he was about 8 years old, Captain Anthony decided to send him to Baltimore to live with relatives of the master. And this was actually the brother of Aaron Anthony's son-in-law. Anthony's son-in-law was a man named Thomas Auld, who had married Captain Anthony's daughter, a woman by the name of Miss Lucretia. And so Douglass went to Baltimore to live with Hugh and Sophia Auld. And they had a little boy who was a little younger than Douglass by a few months, I think. And he was to become the companion. And for the next 7 years, he lived with them. But he'd only been with them perhaps a few days, maybe as long as a week, when he was expressing an interest in pictures that were in one of the school books that belonged to Tommy Auld, the son. And Tommy Auld was named after his uncle Thomas, that same man who was the son-in-law of their owner, Captain Anthony. And in any case, Mrs. Auld, when she saw that he was looking at these pictures of animals and things like that, she asked him if he wanted to learn how to read. And he said, "I'm not quite sure what you mean by that, ma'am," but she offered to teach him. And so she taught him the alphabet, and he learned that very quickly. And then she began to teach him how to spell words.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with actor Fred Morsell about Frederick Douglass. You see, Fred Morsell has been portraying Frederick Douglass
for about 30 years, and he is an absolute wealth of information about that important and often overlooked historical figure. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Fred Morsell. Stay tuned. Once again, it's time for our constitutional quiz with our quiz lady from Montpelier, Kelly Carmichael. Are you with us?
Hi, Stuart. How are you?
I'm doing so well. I'm just so happy. I could go on at great length, but then I would bore people. So I'll simply say, yes, I'm doing well. And how about you?
Oh, I'm great. Everything at James Madison's Montpelier is just beautiful as always.
As always. Well, we have a contestant with us. She's extremely nervous.
Oh, no.
So we're going to have to be very gentle with her today. Ms. Contestant, will you tell us your name and where you're from?
My name is Susanna Hedlund, and I'm from Asheville, North Carolina.
All right, Susanna, are you going to pass out on us? Or are you going to be
Probably.
Able to do... No, I think you'll do just fine. Thank you for coming in today. Kelly, what do you have for Susanna?
All right, Susanna, here's your question. No need to be scared, but fortunately we're not near each other if you need to throw anything at me. All right, Susanna, here's a question for you. Looking at the Constitution and amendments in the Constitution. Since the Constitution was ratified in 1789, more than 10,000 amendments have been introduced in Congress. How many amendments have been formally added to the Constitution? Is it A, 10, B, 27, C, 37, or D, 40?
Say the answers one more time.
A, 10 amendments, B, 27 amendments, C, 37 amendments, or D, 40 amendments.
And Susanna is being so good. She actually has in her hand a pocket copy of the Constitution.
Oh, no, you can't. We let another contestant one time do that, and you know that this she has to know.
But she very, very morally declined to open it, and she is puzzling over these choices. Why don't you talk us through and tell us?
Very good, Susanna.
Well, I'm gonna make a guess here. Actually.
You're just going to make with no explanation at all. Well, talk us through. Tell us why you would choose or not choose A. A is 10.
From what I recall, there are more than that.
There are more than that. Okay. Yes. In fact, we had the Bill of Rights. They were the first 10, and so you think there's something beyond them.
Yes.
All right. So 10 is off.
Okay. My answer choice that I'm going to go with, and I'm probably wrong, is going to be C.
C, 37?
Yes.
Okay, but before we get there, why not B, 27?
I think there are more than that.
You just think there are more than that?
Yes, I think there are more than that.
Okay, and so then D, 40 is close to 37. Why not 40, right?
It's too even of an answer.
Oh, it's too even?
I'm
going to
go with C.
You're going to go with C, and C is your final answer.
C is my final answer.
Kelly?
Susanna, close, but no cigar, my friend. The answer is 27 amendments. And, you know, that's tough because, you know, more than 10,000 amendments have been proposed, and it takes quite a long process for an amendment to actually come into our Constitution. If you actually be amended into the Constitution, or ratified into the Constitution, if you actually... think about it. Since 1789, only 27 amendments have been added into our Constitution. It's very impressive.
Susanna, you should not feel the least bit bad about that, because I doubt that most Americans would have any idea how many there are. But it's an important point, because the first 10 amendments were introduced and ratified within just 3 years of the initial 4 years of the initial adoption of the document. And they were all ratified in 1791. So if you think about it, most people consider the Bill of Rights almost part of the original Constitution. So really, since 1791, it's only been amended 17 times. Article 5 of the original Constitution sets out a very difficult and laborious and lengthy ratification process for amendments. And that's an important point to remember. It's hard,
hard to amend the Constitution, and that's by design.
So, absolutely. Absolutely. And even if you go back and, you know, now that you were great, Susanna, not opening your Constitution and finding the answer. But if you go and open it now and look at the 27th Amendment, that was actually originally proposed as part of the original 10 Bill of Rights in 1789. Didn't get passed or ratified until 1992.
That is such a cool point you make, because you're right. If you look at the Bill of Rights, I think there were something like 16 that were proposed and only 10 ultimately that were ratified in 1791. But then there are those extra ones that were hanging out around there, and there was no expiration date on them.
Mm-hmm.
So when the final state ratified the 27th Amendment, it was, you know, like 200 years later. And I wonder if there are any others just hanging out there that could still be ratified. I'm not, off the top of my head, I'm not sure.
Right, because now there's limits of how long states have to actually ratify an amendment.
And that's actually the reason.
If you pass that time limit, then the amendment has to basically start back at, you know, ground zero.
Right. In fact, when new amendments are proposed, they almost always have time limits included with them. And probably the most famous example of an expiration was the proposed Equal Rights Amendment back in the 1970s. And it looked like it was on its way to being ratified, and it very well might have been if there had been no time limit. But since there was one, it failed ultimately. Okay, well, thank you, Susanna,
very much
for taking our quiz. And thank you, Kelly.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with actor Fred Morsell about Frederick Douglass. Before the break, Fred was telling me that one of Frederick Douglass's owners actually did one of the most dangerous things you could do with a slave. She taught him to read.
Were they breaking the law then?
No, because he was about to learn some three or four words that had three and four letters in them, that's when Hewald, the husband, came home and saw what was happening. And he immediately raised all kinds of hell about that. And he threw books across the room. He told his wife, you cannot do that. It's against the law to teach a slave how to read. Now, the truth is, it was against the law in some states. It was not against the law in Maryland, but it was against custom. Okay? So he was actually incorrect when he said that, but it was very much against custom. Because his comment was, and I will not use the word, actually, but Douglas, he says, he uses the N-word all the time, says, if you teach a slave how to read, it will forever unfit him to be a slave. And those words, you see, Douglas was 8 years old when he heard that. He didn't quite understand what that meant, but he did know one thing. He did understand from the intensity of the anger of Hugh Auld and the shock at that moment was that if he could learn how to read, he could not be a slave. That he understood. And he realized that even though he didn't understand what that could ultimately mean, he knew he did not want to be a slave. And the only way he felt he could do that, could achieve that, was to learn how to read. And he was really right on target. And so he got the white boys in his neighborhood in Alexander Street in Fells Point, Baltimore, to teach him how to read. And in order to get them to do that, he gave away his food, because they were all very, very poor mostly and didn't have a lot of food to eat. They were always hungry. But Douglas was given free access to the kitchen whenever he wanted, particularly after this experience. And so he took biscuits and gave them to the boys. And over a period of months, gave away a great deal, as he would say, of Sophia Auld's bread. But he received that much greater bread of knowledge from these white boys. And they taught him how to write. And then when he was about 12 years old, still living in Baltimore with the Auld family, he purchased a copy of a very important book called The Columbian Orator. And that book was published by a schoolmonger, I think in Vermont, by the name of Caleb Bingham. And it was published initially, I think, in 1799. I got a copy of it, a Xerox copy of it, I should say, from the American Antiquarian Society a number of years ago. And Douglas got this book, and it's a book that was filled with speeches and short dramas and little theatrical pieces written by this school teacher, Bingham, that all extolled the virtues of the human spirit. There were speeches by Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, Napoleon Bonaparte. Some of them, I'm sure, are things that he himself created, but many of them are things he was able to find from various libraries and other books as well. And so Douglas found this book, and this book taught him the power of the spoken word, and the power of the written word. And he read that book over and over again because, as he says, the more I read these speeches, the better I understood them. Because in understanding them and having the words become part of his consciousness, he was able to gain a greater sense of ability to think.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, Fred, but elocution as a subject, the art of speaking publicly, was something that was widely taught in the 19th century.
It was called the art of oration, or eloquence.
Mm-hmm.
It's called eloquence, and it was taught. Everyone had to learn it. That's one of the things that makes things so very, very difficult for our society today, when we have so much slovenly use of the English language, and when people just think the words are meaningless. And it's a terrible, terrible indictment of our culture that we have so little regard for the spoken word. I have students sometimes ask me, well, what do you mean by the power of the spoken word? And I always get a chuckle out of it. I say, well, if you ever want to find out what the power of the spoken word is, go to any good black Baptist church on a Sunday. You'll find out what it's all about. You know, I mean, not necessarily, you don't have to go to always black ones, but you know what I'm saying.
I know what you're saying.
The fact is, you need to hear someone using the, quote, King's English in a way that moves, that motivates. Because words are actually, they need to be pronounced completely so that you can get the full energy that is inherent in the word itself. It's basically like a cup of energy,
mm-hmm.
a cup of light. So the bottom line is, eloquence was something that he was learning. And, of course, in the 19th century, you know, people would go to hear lectures, and they didn't have a 3.5-minute attention span the way we have today. I mean, they would go for 5 hours.
Yeah.
And if anything was less than that, that was considered, they were being shortchanged.
That was a form of entertainment.
Yeah, that was their form of entertainment. I mean, when Mark Twain was giving his speeches and things in the 1880s and 1870s, I mean, people would come, they expected to be there for 5 or 6 hours.
You know, that's funny you should mention that, because my understanding is that while current Supreme Court arguments in the United States Supreme Court are limited typically to an hour or less for all sides,
yes.
They would go on literally for days back in the 19th century.
Yes.
And people would go to watch Daniel Webster or Henry Clay or somebody arguing in front of the court, and it
yes.
was considered great entertainment.
Well, it was. And, I mean, these were men and women, well, mostly men, but the women, even like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Anthony in the 1840s, 1850s, and so on and beyond, many of these ladies, were Lydia Maria Child, they were terrific. You know, Sojourner Truth. These people got up to speak, and it wasn't they got up to give a sound bite. They got up to give a speech. That could be 2.5 hours. That's why when you read Douglass's speeches, many of them, like the 4th of July speech or the 5th of July speech, however that people want to call it, the meaning of the 4th of July for the Negro that he gave in 1852 in Rochester, when you read the full speech, it's about a 2-hour speech. But nobody can listen to it. So when I recorded it a number of years ago for TBM Records in Connecticut, we only did about 45 minutes of it because, you know, we have to fit it into a one half of a audio cassette or
mm-hmm.
whatever, you know what I'm saying, because
mm-hmm.
people are not accustomed today to hearing good language. I do believe, however, that if people had an opportunity to really listen to great speaking, really tremendous speeches, they would be much more willing to stay and listen for hours and hours and hours as opposed to 15 minutes. But it's a different culture.
Well, there was a fair amount of your profession involved in that sort of public speaking, because it wasn't merely getting up there and reading from a text. It was getting up there and putting that feeling into the words and moving people emotionally, even as you appealed to their reason.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that people, you know, when they would go to see a Shakespearean play, it was a 4-hour or 5-hour event. It wasn't some kind of thing. Now when we get ready to do a Shakespearean plays, I'm not going to be doing this, but... And I don't do this when I direct Shakespeare, but the reality is when people, the first thing we sit down and say, okay, let's go over the cut.
Right.
The thing is that you cannot really cut something that is a homeopathic whole that is in and of itself complete and it cannot be changed. It's like thinking I'm going to take something out of the Bible and it's still going to retain its original sense. Well, that's not accurate. That's not true.
We want the Cliff's Notes version.
Yeah, no. Well, Cliff Notes are fine if you want to get a sort of a general picture, but That's not. I mean, if you know, if I'm going to see a lawyer, I don't want him using cliff notes when he's up there defending me. I want him giving me everything he's got.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's. But you know what? I mean, I'm being a little silly on this, but the reality is that is something that Douglas grew up with. So the bottom line is, he was about 16 years of age, and he'd been living with the Hugh Auld family in Baltimore for 7 years or thereabouts. And Hugh Auld and Thomas Auld had a kind of an argument or disagreement. And by this time, Captain Aaron Anthony had died, and Thomas Auld was now the owner of Frederick. And so Thomas Auld ordered Frederick from the Eastern Shore, from Baltimore back to the Eastern Shore, and he remained there for the next 2 to 3 years. He was hired out to a slave breaker by the name of Edward Covey. He engaged in
A slave breaker?
Slave breaker. A slave breaker was a white man who was hired to break slaves of their stubbornness, of their intransigence, of their unwillingness to be obedient, and so on and so forth. And Edward Covey is the man's name.
Oh, my goodness. That's just, it's a variation on the theme of a horse breaker or an animal breaker.
Well, you hit the nail right on the head.
Good grief. And I guess that means then that young Frederick was identified as someone who was already a bit resistant?
Very much resistant. When he got back to the Eastern Shore, to Thomas Auld's home and store in the town near the town of Easton, he was kind of stubborn. He was resistant, and you know, in the words of Harry Belafonte years ago, he had a very independent way of thinking, very independent mind. And as a result, after 9 months, even though he was occasionally beaten and whipped by Thomas Auld, he was never really cruelly treated. But Thomas Auld hired him out for 1 year to this slave breaker, Edward Covey. And when most people, when they read the name Covey, they assume it's Covey, because that's a very contemporary way of pronouncing that name. But a man by the name of Dixon Preston, who was an author and editor of newspapers on Maryland's Eastern Shore, published a book in 1980 or 81 entitled Frederick Douglass, The Maryland Years. And it's in that book that Mr. Preston discovered all kinds of things, not the least of which was in the Maryland archive, the statement of Frederick Douglass's birth in February 1818, which Douglass always assumed was 1817. He never saw that document, so he never really knew what year he was born, or what day for that matter. And he also found other things as well, that the last time that Harriet Bailey saw her son Frederick, when he was about 7 years of age, she called him her little Valentine. And she gave him a little, as he says, a little heart-shaped ginger cake. And so from that perspective and that understanding, we have all come to the conclusion, probably, that his birthday was Valentine's Day.
Hmm.
And he was born in 1818. But also, Mr. Preston discovered that the name was pronounced Covey, not Covey. And that's very important to know that.
So and he was the slave breaker.
But he was the slave breaker, yeah. One of the things that Preston points out is that one would like to think that a man who was as cruel and earned his living as in such a insidious way as Edward Covey did, that he would suffer in life greatly. But it turned out that by the time he died, he was really one of the wealthiest men in the entire region.
Oh, boy.
So, justice is always, as the saying goes, belongs to God, not to me.
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line is that he was there. He was beaten by Edward Covey probably at least once or twice a week for the first 6 or 7 months he was there. But in August of 1833, and Douglass's years sometimes may be a little off, it might be actually 34, actually, as opposed to 33. In any case, he resists the beating. And while he doesn't fight Covey in the sense of exchanging blows so much, they wrestle basically for a couple of hours. And finally, Covey lets him go and releases him. And the question is, well, why didn't Covey report Douglass to the authorities? Because for a slave, particularly, or any black man for that matter, to raise his or her hand against a white person was punishable by death in virtually every state of the South where slavery existed. But the answer is that because Covey's reputation was built as a slave owner, a slave breaker, he couldn't let people know that he had been unable to beat the slave.
Oh, of course, right.
So he never said anything. And so the bottom line is that Douglass was able to basically sort of change his the way he was treated from that point forward. Chloe would say to him, I don't want to ever get a hold of you again. But then again, he never raised his hand against Douglas. But Frederick was still, at this point, Frederick Bailey. He was hired to a man by the name of William Freeland for the next year, and after that, Freeland hired him for a second year. And it was during that second year, which I believe was the year was 1835 into 1830 or 1836, that Douglas plotted with several other slave boys, some of whom were relatives like cousins, and one of them was an uncle, to escape at Easter time of 1836. However, the escape was betrayed by one of the other slaves who finally separated himself from the plot, and they were all put in jail. And Frederick, because it was known that he could read and write, he was considered the ringleader, and in point of fact, he was the ringleader. And the people in the area around Easton told Thomas Auld that if he did not get rid of Frederick in some way, they were going to murder him. And one of the aspects of slavery in terms of relations between the slave and the slave owner sort of comes to bear here, which teaches us that Frederick, that Thomas Auld did not want to kill Frederick and did not want to let him be murdered, so he sent him back to his brother in Baltimore.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with the actor, Fred Morsell, a fellow who's been portraying the abolitionist, Frederick Douglass, for several decades, and who knows a great deal about that often overlooked historical person. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll come back and we'll talk some more with Fred Morsell. Stay tuned.
According to the closing resolution of the Constitutional Convention, the newly minted Constitution should be laid before the existing government of the United States, the Confederation Congress, so that the Congress could in turn submit the Constitution to state conventions for ratification. The Constitution's framers had probably assumed that the process in Congress should be only a formality and that the real decision-making would take place in the state ratifying conventions. Instead, a heated debate ensued among the congressmen. Some of them insisted that the proposed Constitution should be significantly amended before submission to the states. James Madison believed that any amendments would complicate and confuse matters and might well prevent ratification. Madison's allies in the Confederation Congress eventually prevailed, and the Constitution was sent to the state conventions for ratification in its original form. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and let's continue our conversation now with actor Fred Morsell, who's telling us about Frederick Douglass's first attempt to escape from slavery.
So Douglass goes back to Baltimore in 1836, and he winds up becoming a caulker under Hugh Auld. And 2 years later, in September of 1838, actually September 3rd, through the aegis of a free black woman by the name of Anna Murray, whom he had met and with whom he had fallen in love, he was able to escape via the Underground Railroad from Baltimore, Maryland, on Monday, the 3rd of September, to Havre de Grace, Maryland, the ferry boat across the Susquehanna River, the train to Wilmington, Delaware, and then the steamboat across the Delaware River to Philadelphia. And arriving in Philadelphia in the afternoon of the 3rd of September, he inquired of a colored man, these are his own words, how to get to New York. He was directed to the Willow Street Depot. Thither he went, taking train that night. He arrived in New York City on September 4th, Tuesday morning, no longer a slave, but hardly a free man. It took him about 24 hours to make contact with the Underground Railroad in that city, David C. Ruggles, who was the black man. And made contact with Ruggles. Ruggles hid him for a number of days. And during that time, he was able to contact Anna Murray in Baltimore, and being a free black woman, when she learned that Douglass was safely with the abolitionists, she came to New York City on the 15th of September, 1838. They were married. And they were then directed by David Ruggles to go to New Bedford, Massachusetts, Massachusetts, where they said he would be able to obtain work as a caulker. Race prejudice, however, prevented that from happening, because the employers told him at the docks that if they hired him, all the white men would walk off the job. Hmm. And so Frederick, from that point forward, had to get other kind of work. He and Anna hired themselves out as domestics and so on and so forth. And over a period of 2 years, they were able to support themselves. And just about a little bit more than 9 months after they were married, their first child, Rosetta, was born in June of 1839. And they subsequently had four more children.
And he's in his early 20s at this point.
Yeah, he's 20 and a half years old when they got married. And that's 1838. So when he's about 23, almost going on 24, in the summer of 1841, while he was in New Bedford, he had heard about William Lloyd Garrison. He had heard about the abolition even before he left Baltimore. And he began to listen to Garrison. He subscribed to Garrison's newspaper, The Liberator. He had a chance to hear and meet Mrs. Lucretia Mott. Said that she was like a goddess when she would sit on a platform, her silent presence made others eloquent.
Mm-hmm.
She was one of the great, great, great influences in his life. Just the general kind of integrity and selflessness within her consciousness, within her world, was something that just really affected Douglas profoundly. His name was changed to Douglas shortly after he arrived there, because he had changed his name from Bailey, obviously, so he could avoid being captured, and nobody knew where he was. And so at one
right.
point
that's an important point, Fred, and I want to point that out. I mean, they've escaped from slavery. They've crossed the Mason-Dixon line.
Yeah.
But he's a fugitive now, isn't he?
He's a fugitive, absolutely. And he's been a fugitive from the moment he arrives in New York City, actually from the moment he gets on the train in Baltimore.
Right.
And he changes his name from Frederick Bailey, obviously, to Frederick Johnson, then it's under Frederick Smith. He was Frederick Stanley at one point, and Frederick Johnson. And interestingly enough, when he was on that ferry boat going across the Susquehanna River, he did not realize it. While he was standing there on the ferry boat, all of a sudden he heard somebody call out to him, "Fred Bailey, hey, hello, Fred Bailey." And looked up, and there was a black hand on the boat
who recognized
him from Baltimore.
Oh, boy.
And he said, I had to get away from that man as fast as I could.
Mm-hmm.
Because the man didn't know to keep his mouth shut.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was one of the common things that was understood by most slaves, that if you see a slave in circumstances other than normally, you keep your mouth shut. But this guy did not. His man's name was Nichols. In any case, when they got to New Bedford, their contact and the man at whose home they stayed was a man named Nathan Johnson, who was a caterer, and a very wealthy caterer he was in New Bedford. And he and his wife allowed Frederick and Anna to stay with them for a number of days, during which time they learned how they could get an apartment and a place to stay and begin to earn a living and so on and so forth. And it was Mr. Nathan Johnson who was reading Sir Walter Scott's The Lady of the Lake when he said, "Frederick, you know, I know you've given yourself the name of Johnson, and you and Anna don't realize this, but virtually every fugitive slave who leaves Maryland and comes to New Bedford, they all call themselves Johnson."
Why was that?
Because it was a very common name.
Oh, okay.
It was a very common name. And so he had no idea about this. But Mr. Johnson pointed out to him that the leading character in the poem is a character by the name of Douglas, but it's spelled with one S, and he encourages Douglas to change his name. And I always like to tell you to do a little thing of it when I'm in schools and with large audiences, and I tell people that, you know, he said to Mr. Johnson, I don't know that he actually said it, but I just do it as a thing that I can do as an actor. And I said, well, the truth is that... I said, "Mr. Johnson, having just gotten married, I believe it might be a very wise idea if I discussed this matter with my wife first."
Yeah, that would be a good idea.
You know, I always, as I said, don't you think it was a good idea? And I have yet to have anybody say no. You know, they do that.
Well, where did the second S come from then?
Oh, that's the reason. I found that out. I was watching something on E&E, a program they did on Frederick Douglass a number of years ago. And it turns out that... He wanted to make the name as unique and special for themselves as he could. So they added the second S.
Oh, that was just by design.
Just by design.
We're going to be the Douglases with two S's. Okay.
We are the Douglases named after Douglas of the Lady of the Lake, but we are Douglas with two S's.
Okay.
We give ourselves a new life and a new land.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with actor Fred Morsell. about the fellow he's been portraying for the last 30 years, a fellow you may have heard of, Frederick Douglass. Now, here's the bad news. I'm going to have to end my interview with Fred for the moment and put you off until next week to hear the remainder of it, but that's something to look forward to, so don't get too upset. Here's the good news. In the few minutes that remain to us, I'm going to be speaking to one of my students. His name is Ryan James, and Ryan is here for two reasons. First of all, because he's the guy who found Fred Morcell for me, so I'm going to thank Ryan for that. But he's also done some independent research on some very interesting aspects of Frederick Douglass's life. Well, Ryan James, welcome to your weekly Constitutional.
It's a pleasure to be here, Professor. Thank you for having me.
Now, before we start in about Frederick Douglass, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself. Now, who are you and where do you come from?
I am, as you mentioned, Ryan James. I'm from a small town in New Jersey called mm-hmm. South Orange. Seton Hall University is the college in my hometown. Mm-hmm. I've been here at Appalachian School of Law for now a year and a half. I'm in my second year. Prior to that, I worked in finance for roughly 7-8 years on mm-hmm. Wall Street, some of the big companies up there. And mm-hmm. I actually graduated from a small school in Pennsylvania, Wilkes University, Wilkesboro. I was
Right up in the northeastern part of the state.
Correct. Just outside of the Poconos, and played some football up there. And here I am, studying law.
And you've been coaching the football team at Grundy High School, haven't you?
I had been. I had been.
And, right. And I decided... helped him win a few victories along the way.
I'd like to think I contributed somewhat.
I know you did. And so we're very happy to have you with us. Now, of course, it was during our constitutional law class that you approached me and said that you were very interested in Frederick Douglass and that you wanted to do some research on him. So thank you for finding Fred Morcell for me.
No problem.
I think that's already paid off. I mean, this is a fascinating interview we're in the middle of. And then you did some independent research about some aspects of Douglass's life. So what have you learned?
I did. First and foremost, there was a meeting that took place between Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln back in 1863.
Between him and the president?
That's correct, okay. Yeah. He managed to breach the White House, if you will.
Wow.
But that meeting was shortly after the Emancipation Proclamation, which obviously went into effect in January of 1863. And Frederick Douglass's purpose, if you will, for being there was equality amongst the blacks that were serving in the Northern Army, the Union Army. Mm-hmm. There was a fear there that the treatment of black soldiers at that time didn't equate to what the white soldiers were.
Oh, yeah, of course. Well, let's give a little bit of background. In fact, I'm going to draw upon my earlier interview some months ago with Paul Finkelman about the Emancipation Proclamation. There had been black soldiers in the Union Army pretty much since the beginning of the war because they were essentially escaped slaves.
That's correct.
And that was happening since at least, actually very early in the war, and then what started as a trickle became a flood, and they were serving in a variety of capacities by this point. So this, by 1863, it had become quite a big issue, hadn't it?
That's correct. And by that time, I mean, you had black soldiers who were, I wouldn't call them generals, but certainly high-ranking mm-hmm. within the Army ranks. And, mm-hmm. and Frederick Douglass actually termed this war the Abolition War. He thought that it was much more than just North versus South. This was an opportunity for African Americans as a whole, in essence, to finally cement their status within the Union as people, mm-hmm. whereas the Constitution, as we know it from its inception, considered African Americans property. Mm-hmm. So the approach there was to do away with that entirely. Mm-hmm. Now, when Douglass first met with Lincoln, he wanted to do this piecemeal. He intended, for the most part, to ensure that blacks were the soldiers were treated as white soldiers were, that they were treated with dignity when mm-hmm. they were captured, because again, you know, sometimes in war you are captured instead of killed. Mm-hmm. When they returned home, he wanted them to be celebrated as were white soldiers. And again, you go out to fight for your country, fight for the very freedoms that the Constitution swore to afford us all, mm-hmm. and you return home from that battlefield, and here you are, continue to be, you know, oppressed, and in some cases lynched, mm-hmm. in some cases just abandoned. And Frederick Douglass, you know, in this meeting with Lincoln, approached him on this subject and saying, "Mr. President, I respect you as a man. I think you're a very honest, stand-up guy. Here are some of the concerns we have." Now, the key to that was there was an incentive for Lincoln to really pay attention to this, because Lincoln not only wanted to win the war, but he needed re-election. Mm-hmm. And obviously there's strength in numbers. So Lincoln knew at that moment that this was something that, at least by piecemeal, he wanted to incorporate, you know, really starting to integrate African Americans into the culture.
And so he was willing to do that.
It appears so. By the end of the meeting, Frederick Douglass came out of that meeting with just absolute praise for Abraham Lincoln. I mean, he referred to him as a great man. He really trusted him and was so sold on Abraham Lincoln as this stand-up truthful guy that he truly believed that Abraham Lincoln would, in fact, begin to openly denounce slavery and take some steps to improve the overall livelihood of African Americans.
Right. Well, you know, the war started, of course, as a at least from the Union's perspective, primarily as a way of preserving the Union, and of course, slavery was the cause underneath all of that. But eventually, the Union did adopt more of an abolitionist rationale for the war as well, and that became more and more of a purpose for the war, for the government. And I guess this meeting with Douglass was part of that process with Lincoln.
It certainly had a heck of a lot to do with it. It's pretty well documented that Abraham Lincoln himself was not absolutely for getting rid of slavery, and with good reason. It had an economic ramification to it.
Mm-hmm.
The labor that built this country was done on the backs of slaves and for free. You know, you didn't have to pay to have structures built and land cultivated and cropping and you know, the chain of commerce during that time was really at no cost to white landowners. And that was where Lincoln knew that, you know, this is really going to change the scope of how we interact in terms of commerce here in this country. A lot of people stood to lose.
Mm-hmm.
So it took some real, you know, gutsy persuasion from this mere peasant, former slave in Frederick Douglass to convince Abraham Lincoln that these steps were necessary in order to, as the Constitution stated, you know, create this perfected union.
Well, thank you very much, Ryan James, for sharing that very interesting account of that meeting between Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln with us. And come on back next week and we'll talk a little bit more about Fred Douglass.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
Liberty won by white men would lose half its luster. Who would be free themselves must strike the first blow. Better even to die free than to live slaves. The relation between the white and colored people of this country is the great paramount imperative and all-consuming question for this age and the nation to solve. The destiny of the colored American is the destiny of America.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to my student, Ryan James, for coming in and telling us all about Frederick Douglass. And thanks, of course, to him for finding me, Fred Morsell. And thanks to Fred Morsell himself, who is telling us such a fascinating tale about his experience as an actor portraying Douglass, and, of course, about Douglass's biography itself. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Larry Mayer and Bob Hoffman. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.